You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend, and this is Attention, Please.
Can I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
May I have your attention, please?
Can I have your attention, please?
On the 6th and 9th of August, our world commemorates the 78th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. The use of nuclear weapons in these cities killed civilians and military personnel indiscriminately and highlighted the terrible, inhumane consequences for survivors. Setsuko Thurlo, peace activist and survivor of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, said, "As a schoolgirl, I witnessed my city, Hiroshima, blinded by the flash, flattened by the hurricane-like blast, burned in the heat of 4,000 degrees Celsius, and contaminated by the radiation of one atomic bomb. These weapons have always been immoral." After years of research and planning, U.S. officials and scientists overseeing the Manhattan Project were startlingly unprepared for the emergence of evidence of long-term effects of radiation generated by the atomic bomb, even after the Trinity test in July 1945 and the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Joining us today is Anne Wright, Colonel, U.S. Army, retired, and former U.S. State Department diplomat. She spoke in Port Townsend on August 4th. Anne served 29 years in the U.S. Army and Army Reserves and 16 years in the U.S. Diplomatic Corps. She received the State Department's Award for Heroism for her actions during the evacuation of 2,500 people from the Civil War in Sierra Leone, at the time the largest evacuation since Saigon. She was on the first State Department team to go to Afghanistan and helped reopen the embassy there in December of 2001. In 2003, on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, Anne cabled a letter of resignation to Secretary of State Colin Powell, stating that without the authorization of the UN Security Council, the invasion and occupation would be a violation of international law. She was one of three U.S. diplomats that resigned in March of that year. Anne Wright, welcome to KPTZ, and welcome back to Port Townsend.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Anne, I have a question for you to start off. What was the reality of risks you took when you made your stand back in 2003?
Well, I was essentially giving up my career as a State Department official, as a U.S. diplomat. You know, I really didn't know what my future was going to be. I certainly knew that the U.S. government didn't want to have anything more to do with me, if resigning on principle over the pending war on Iraq. And since my whole life had really been wrapped up in U.S. government service, both in the military and then as a diplomat, I really was unclear what I was going to be doing after I resigned. But I felt so strongly that the war on Iraq was just going to be horrible for everybody. I wasn't about to have anything to do with it. So I kind of jumped into the breach in terms of not having a clue what I was going to do. And it turned out it was a great move in terms of an act of conscience and then finding a whole community of people that have been challenging U.S. government policies and war policies in particular for decades. So it turned out to be a very good move on all levels.
What do you think personally gave you the strength to make those decisions? What I mean is that were there influences from family or childhood or mentors that kind of shaped your sense of social justice and peace?
Well, not really. I mean, I joined the military and spent 29 years in it, and that's certainly not a peaceful organization. So I think what it really was a culmination of watching a lot of U.S. government policies that I didn't agree with, but I hadn't resigned over them. But then this one of invading and occupying an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had nothing to do with 9/11, and trying to figure out how the Bush administration was coming up with this weapons of mass destruction theory when there were so many scientists and inspectors that were saying the Iraqi government no longer had weapons of mass destruction. And with that, it was like, well, I'm just not going to go along with any more of these policies that this particular administration was coming up with. At that point, I'd worked for 8 different presidential administrations, and there were plenty of things in each one of them that I didn't agree with personally, but I didn't resign over it. But this one I felt was the war on Iraq was going to be so invasive of so many aspects of U.S. foreign policy that I just decided I just wasn't about to have anything to do with it.
Well, you've been writing and speaking about peace since then. What activities are you involved with currently? From what I've been reading, you've been involved with a number of them.
You know, the various wars that the U.S. has gotten involved in, certainly that's part of it, is challenging why the U.S. seems to think that war should be the foreign policy that it has, rather than trying to use diplomacy to resolve international disputes and confrontations. So I've worked on Korea peace on the Korean Peninsula. In fact, I was just in Washington, D.C. for the national mobilization to end the war in Korea, because there is only an armistice that's been signed 70 years ago. And we know of the confrontations and the tensions that are on the peninsula and the potential for the use of nuclear weapons by a mistake, by who knows what might trigger something as horrible as the use of nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula or in the Ukraine and Russia with that conflict that's going on. So I've worked for peace in Ukraine, peace on the Korean Peninsula, lessening tensions with other countries that have always been on the U.S. target list for regime change, to include Cuba and Iran. I also work on the issue of Palestinian rights and challenging the brutal Israeli oppression on Palestinians. So those are some of the things I work on. Oh, and also I was a speaker at the Global Women for Peace Say No to NATO in Brussels earlier in July. So really challenging a lot of U.S. government policies is kind of the heart of what I've been doing.
That's kind of triggering a side question here about U.S. policy and what it considers to be best for the interests of the United States and what that has to do with regime change. And what happens, you know, because you've been involved with diplomacy, you had been involved with diplomacy for quite some time, and you've probably seen the dark side and the bright side of what it takes to be a spokesperson for the United States.
Well, yeah, it's difficult to be a spokesperson for the United States in many situations, particularly when U.S. policies are essentially overthrowing governments. And sometimes the governments are dictatorships, but other times they are elected, democratically elected governments that just don't have policies that the United States likes. And, you know, those are the things that we really go after. I mean, in Cuba, they, even though it's you know, socialist and one could say communist country, it still has elections. And, you know, the president of the country is elected. And yet for 60 years, the United States policy has essentially been regime change and putting as many sanctions on Cuba as possible to try to get the people of Cuba to rise up, to revolt, to overthrow the government, and then let all the people that have fled Cuba to go back and get their industries and all of that, for which they have already been paid. That's one of the features of this that is seldom reported in the United States, but the Cuban government paid those individuals and companies that were nationalized by the Cuban government back in the 1950s. Analyzing what the U.S. is really doing and why it's doing it is really important for us as citizens. And we should challenge and take with a grain of salt the rationale that the U.S. government is giving for the sanctions and the oppression, actually, that they're putting on a lot of countries. Right now, the confrontation with China and the huge number of sanctions that we put on China is, in my opinion, really, to the rest of the world, it looks like, what in the world are you doing? The Chinese are the ones that are making our clothes, they're making our cell phones, they're making everything for us. They are giving us the opportunity to have material goods for much less cost than if they were made in the United States or in Western Europe. And the U.S. says, well, you know, there's the theft of intellectual property rights, there's human rights abuses, there's this, that, and the other thing. And I'm sure there's a token amount of each one of it, but it's not like the Chinese are the only ones that are doing it. It appears to me that the U.S. government ought to be sanctioned for all of our human rights abuses here in the United States, for our theft of intellectual property, for our persecution of journalists and things like that. So it kind of galls me that the U.S. Government, no matter whether it's Republican or Democratic administration, feels that it has the right to kind of be the policeman of the world, to make the rules for the world order, the U.S. version of what the world ought to be.
Speaking of superpowers and the ways that the superpowers feel that they should be balancing themselves against one another, there's the potential for destruction that our nuclear weapons carry these days, you know, just from a single bomb, exponentially greater than only one Hiroshima or Nagasaki bomb. What are your feelings about mutually assured destruction as a philosophy and as a concept to keep the peace?
Well, you always hope that no country will want to use a nuclear weapon because they are pretty well assured that somebody will use it on them. So, you know, that's the whole thing of mutually assured destruction. Nobody will use it. And I certainly hope that's true. I think the better thing is for the elimination of them and trying to get the United States and Russia that have the most of them to go ahead and eliminate all of them, and then bring along the newer countries that have developed these nuclear weapons for whatever purpose it is, whether, you know, for Pakistan and China, it's the squaring off of those two countries, or whether it's, I don't know why France needs them, or, you know, the UK. Israel thinks that that's kind of a ace in their pocket. And certainly North Korea says, well, it is the one thing we have that may prevent the United States from actually attacking us and doing regime change on us. And they used the point that Gaddafi in Libya gave up their nuclear program, and you see what happened to Gaddafi. So, you know, the North Koreans are, in my opinion, having been in North Korea in 2015 with Women Cross the Demilitarized Zone, a group of 30 international women from 15 countries, two Nobel Peace laureates, and having conversations with people in North Korea. They want peace because they know if there's a conflict, they know they're going to get slammed. They're going to die. I don't think they want a conflict at all. And I don't think they want to have a war with South Korea, their brothers and sisters in South Korea. And they don't want to trigger a conflict with the United States. But it's the U.S. that keeps pushing that North Korea is a threat to U.S. national security. And we keep bringing nuclear submarines in. We have B-52s loaded with nuclear weapons and publicized with that. And we bring in 28,000 military and have military war games right on the DMZ. So there's nothing really that we're giving to the North Koreans to give them any confidence that the U.S. has any other objective in mind other than the overthrow of the government.
What do you think the escalating risks are of allowing the use or letting the use of limited nuclear weapons on the battlefield creep into policy?
Oh, well, it's a recipe for disaster. I mean, if you let backpack nuclear weapons go in with soldiers, there's going to be trouble. And anytime any nuclear device, no matter how small it is exploded, then that gives the opposition, just says to the opposition, okay, they've used nuclear weapons and we're going to use them too. So it's a terrible, terrible idea to do it.
What came to mind also were the armor-piercing shells, which have a radioactive element to them.
Right, the depleted uranium shells that we have seen in Iraq in particular, that the use of those by the United States has been so destructive to the people of southern Iraq in particular that the medical studies that show how many deformed babies have been brought into this world by women who were living in that area around where we used depleted uranium. So it's terrible that in the war between Ukraine and Russia that the United States and its allies is kind of going to the bottom of the barrel, so to speak. They have used so much ammunition that now some of the last stuff that's there is depleted uranium shells and cluster bombs. And so they're sending those over, knowing full well what the consequences are. The long-term consequences of depleted uranium are horrible on the medical side. The use of cluster bombs will mean that there will be Ukrainian and Russian kids that will be blown up for the next 50 years, just as we've seen in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, where the U.S. used them 50 years ago.
For those just tuning in, we're speaking with Ann Wright, Colonel, U.S. Army retired, who served for 29 years with the Army and Army Reserves and 16 years of service in the U.S. Diplomatic Corps. Now, an outspoken activist for peace.
You know, and our communities live just across the pond from the naval magazine, Indian Island, and huge supplies of munitions come and go from that installation every month. How do you think the complexion of that installation has changed over the years, meaning what goes in and what comes out?
Well, I don't know that anyone knows for sure what goes in and what goes out, other than it's dangerous and that you are the target. I mean, if there is a conflict and the U.S. becomes, we become a target as we have targeted many other countries, if we finally are on the receiving end of things that other countries are sending toward us, you guys just kiss your sweet ass goodbye, because you're definitely at, as they say, ground zero here. This is one of the primary targets for any adversary the United States has. So that ammunition dump or ammunition facility will be a prime target, as will the nuclear submarine base, as well as the shipyard that's at Bremerton. You all, as I am in Hawaii, I live in Hawaii, so Pearl Harbor, Hickam Air Force Base, Kaneohe Marine Base, the 25th Infantry Division located on Oahu, we know that we are ground zero in the Pacific, as is the island of Guam. I mean, those are three of the places kind of that are on the Pacific or in the Pacific that you can be guaranteed will be the targets of any enemy that tragically decides it will send weapons toward the United States.
And, you know, your activism not only embodies an element of what some folks might perceive as doom and gloom, but also you are an embodiment of what it takes to be an activist and to educate people about a lot of things that are really, really important in our society here today.
Well, I feel that since I've had such a long experience in the U.S. government, both in the military and as a U.S. diplomat and with foreign policy, that it's kind of my duty to give my version of what I think is going on. And of course, not everybody agrees with it, but the analysis that I have is based on the experience that I've had within the government and then continuing to do a lot of research and writing and speaking in the 20 years that I've been out of the government. So I don't think I'm trying to be overly pessimistic, and certainly I'm not optimistic, but what I try to do is present a realistic view of what's going on in the world. And it's it's kind of a duty that you have if you're going to try to work to lessen tensions in the world by speaking here in the U.S. about what our policies are and going to areas all over the world to talk about U.S. policies, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and what the policies are of the countries we go to, whether it's Afghanistan or Pakistan, Yemen, Iran, North Korea, South Korea, Japan. All of these countries are interested in hearing what U.S. citizens have to say about the policies. And I've never run into anyone in any of those countries that say, we want to have a war. They all say, we would really like to live in peace, and we would like to have our national budgets go for peaceful activities rather than being spent on military weapons. I mean, that is a universal hope, I think, in our world, that we can reduce the amount of money that's put into militarism, and that someday we'll have adults in positions of power that will actually work to have a peaceful world rather than just saying they want a peaceful world, and yet the reality of their actions is that they don't really want one. They want one of confrontation, where they can get the military-industrial complex, corporations give them money for their political campaigns, and they will ratchet up tensions in the world just so, you know, people will say, oh, well, we have to have this massive defense budget. The budget for this next year is the largest that the United States has ever had at, I think it's $880 billion right now and probably growing. And, you know, it's like, what is all this stuff for when we could be using it for so many other things? And so that's why I speak out a lot to say to the U.S. government, we've got to come up with a different way of our treatment of our own citizens as well as the treatment of other citizens in our world.
Well, that was a good point that you brought up about, I think anybody that travels abroad will get questioned by the person on the street or the person you meet in the cafe saying, you know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And very often the perspective that someone across the Atlantic has about the United States is worth listening to.
Well, indeed it is. The perspectives of people that are sometimes the recipients of U.S. animosity or even with the allies of why are you guys spending so much money on all this war-making stuff? And you find when you do travel around the world that many times people in other parts of the world know more about our own foreign policies than, you know, somebody that you might meet out here in just our local restaurants. I think a lot of Americans are not really particularly interested in what's going on in the rest of the world. And yet the rest of the world is very interested because they are the ones that see, uh-oh, the U.S. may be trying to do something in our country or neighboring countries that's really going to impact our lives.
Makes me reflect on two things. First of all, we're such a large nation. In Europe, our borders from state to state are from country to country. What that does is that it makes us a little bit of an insular country. And especially in our thinking, we might have different dialects of English as we travel around the United States. It's still really important for us to understand how our government works, number one, and then number two, to be an informed society, accurately informed society.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. You know, we are insulated and isolated. You know, when our government tells us we should not be going to visit other countries, that's one of the things that makes me decide I'm going to go see what's going on in that country that my government doesn't want me to see. And so that's why I go to Cuba frequently. I go to Iran. I go to North Korea. You know, there is a travel ban that the Trump administration put on American citizens going to North Korea. When we went there in 2015, there was no travel ban. If the North Koreans would give you a visa, which most people applied for in Beijing, when you go to China, you apply for it. You know, the rest of the world recognizes North Korea. There are something like 180 countries that recognize the country of North Korea. The United States doesn't. We don't recognize Iran. We don't have an embassy there. We barely recognize Cuba. Under the Obama administration, we did. And then under the Trump administration, we essentially cut off relations and just put more sanctions in. And the Biden administration hasn't lifted those sanctions and really increased the contact with Cuba. So it's these places where the U.S. government says, oh, you know, you shouldn't really go. It's dangerous there. It's this, it's that. It's like, well, that's the red flag that goes up. Okay, let's go see what is happening there and how U.S. policies are affecting the people there.
And what are some of the efforts and projects out there that will help to keep our citizens informed and educated? How can our citizens in this country become involved in order to have their voices heard and make a difference?
Well, there are plenty of organizations that are trying to do exactly that, to educate our public. I belong to Veterans for Peace, an organization primarily of former military, although we do have associate members that are very concerned about military policies. We have Code Pink Women for Peace that work really hard on anti-militarization of our society. We have World Beyond War. We have the United National Anti-War Coalition. Those are just on the militarization and war front. You have lots of environmental organizations that are doing the connection between the, you know, global warming, the increase in huge storms and fires and things like that, and the relationship with militarization. So there are plenty of organizations that are out there, and virtually every community has one or two of them, which, depending on how, you know, what the crisis is in the country or the world, more people will join when there's more crisis, and then when there's not, they kind of fall off. And COVID has certainly reduced the numbers of people that were out doing actions while there were major crises that were going on in the world. So most of the organizations are rebuilding their membership and really having a good educational program. So they're out there. It just takes the moment to Google them, and you'll find plenty of them.
Well, I got one more question for you, Ann. When you get up every day, what's that strong, inherent passion that makes you want to keep on going?
Well, I think it's, you know, being right here in the northwestern part of our own country, and being right here in Port Townsend and all the communities around. It's a beautiful, beautiful world we live in, and we want to preserve the beauty of it, and we want to stop the degradation of it. And so seeing beautiful sights and meeting great people who all they want in their lives are a little peace, you know, an opportunity to just raise their kids in a peaceful community, and trying to preserve what we have and increase the ability of our citizens to live a safer and more peaceful life are things that I think of. And just looking out the window and seeing beautiful sights kind of gets you moving in the right direction, I think.
Living responsibly, eating responsibly, making the effort to seek the truth, all of those things are what keeps all of us going, I think.
Yes, yes indeed it is. And it's a pleasure to be here in this part of the country and to see the beauty that's here, the mountains, the waters, the wildlife is really rejuvenating to be in this part of the world. I'll be leaving here, going back to another place of rejuvenation, which is Hawaii, a beautiful, beautiful place. So, you know, it's a good world, and we have to make it better.
Ann Wright, Colonel, U.S. Army retired, former U.S. State Department diplomat, speaking out in Port Townsend on the anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I like the way you grab a thought and then put it into practice. The way you know when it's time to honor rage. The way you really listen before you start talking. The way you stand on a picket line for a living wage.
You've been listening to Attention Please, which airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and again on Saturdays at noon. This is KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. Our music today was from Holly Near, Peace Becomes You, on Calico Tracks Music. This is Chris Bricker for KPTZ, Community Radio News.